La noticia se ha regado.
¿Qué cosa será?
La guerra de los callados.
Declarada está.
Todo el mundo está enterado.
Confusión total.
La guerra mata al hermano.
Sin discriminar.
En la ciudad y en el monte se enfrentan los enemigos. Bajo el azul horizonte ya son muchos los caídos. La guerra mata al hermano.
Queremos la paz.
And you're listening to the Friday edition of the morning show on WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio. My name is Mario Murillo. And moving forward this morning, taking a look at a story that perhaps you may have missed because it hasn't gotten much attention, and that's the fact that 2015 has been named or declared the International Decade for People of African Descent, with a subtitle from the United Nations, Recognition, Justice, and Development. It was actually introduced and launched at the end of last year, but starting January 1st, we're officially in this decade, which has many implications, and that's what we wanted to focus on this morning on this next segment, and particularly focusing on a local project here in New York, but obviously with global reach, a web-based project that's called the Proyecto Afro-Latino, or the Afro-Latino Project. And joining us in the studio right now is the director of the Afro-Latino Project, a New York native and an attorney, Amilcar Priestley, who is a graduate of Brooklyn Law School and is the director of the Afro-Latino Project. Amilcar, thank you so much for being with us. It's great to have you here.
Good morning, Mario. Thank you. It's a pleasure being here. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit more about the decade and about the proyecto itself.
All right, so we want to talk about the decade in a moment, but first, again, the Afro-Latino Project, it's an extraordinary initiative that that you're taking on with academic and journalistic and community connections, if you will. So if you can just give us a thumbnail sketch of what the Afro-Latino Project is.
Sure. So the Afro-Latino Project was originally founded in 2005 by my father, George Priestley, who was an activist scholar and a professor at Queens College, CUNY, for about four decades.
Knew him well.
Yeah.
Appreciated George greatly. And it was a great loss when he passed.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate it. So after 2009, when he passed away, we took a little hiatus. And then in 2012, we relaunched the project focusing on creating digital archives of Afro-Latino history, cultures, contributions, and experiences. And since that time, since 2012, when we relaunched the project, which is afrolatinoproject.org, we have proceeded to collect over 70 oral histories from over 10 countries throughout Latin America and the Caribbean, as well as here in the United States. We've put together about 2,000 documents and cataloged about 500 of them about Afro-Latinos and contributions and experiences in the Western Hemisphere. And, we're constantly looking to grow that, to have a greater digital presence, especially given that African-Americans, Latinos, Afro-Latinos tend to use digital technology, specifically mobile phone technology, to a great extent. So one of the big things is making sure that our content is accessible via mobile phone so that it can reach the widest audience possible.
Mm-hmm. Why focus on the oral histories and the stories? Who are the people, the voices, the experiences that you're documenting in this project?
Sure. So we've gotten a number of people. We've gotten activists from Panama, Peru, performers, musical performers from Colombia, scholars from Curacao, scholars from Guadeloupe, Cuba. We have a local politician from New York, New York State Assemblyman Robert Rodriguez, from the East Harlem area, who was kind enough to lend his voice, and a number of people. And basically, it's to try to capture a range of who are Afro-Latinos, what their contributions have been. You know, there are a lot of us out here. People may know of some, may not know of others. You may not know that they're Afro-Latino. And so it's to try to provide a breadth of experience to the wider public, especially, as you mentioned, with the decade for people of African descent upon us, so that people can see that there are a lot. I mean, there's 200 million Afro-Latinos in the Western Hemisphere, approximately. And, you know, it's past time that we kind of start to step up and have our voices heard more powerfully.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, about what constitutes an Afro-Latino. Mm-hmm. Who are the, because, for example, in some countries, the undercount is so profound. Mm-hmm. the fact that, you know, the census in countries throughout the Americas mm-hmm. Has always undercounted not only Afro-Latinos, but also indigenous populations. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So who constitutes a country like Colombia, for example, mm-hmm. which I'm very close to, obviously mm-hmm. being from Colombia, mm-hmm. the range, you know, says that, you know, up to 50-60% of the population mm-hmm. Has African roots, mm-hmm. But the census numbers are much lower. Mm-hmm. So how does the Afro-Latino Project deal with this, one of the many complicated issues related to that?
Right. Okay, well, first, the term Afro-descendant came about after the 2001 Durban Conference in Durban, South Africa, and it was a way to kind of embrace all different kinds of Afro-descendant folks within the region who may not necessarily identify as Black, who may not identify as X, Y, and Z. I mean, for example, you gave the example of Colombia. You know, there's the Raizal community from San Andres and Providencia and Catalina. There's the Palenquero community from San Basilio de Palenque. Mm-hmm. There's folks that identify as Negro. There's folks that identify as Afro-descendant or Afro-Colombian. And Panama is a similar trajectory, in other countries, there's similar, there's a diversity within the Afro community, right? And so the term Afro-descendant was a way to kind of embrace all these communities for everyone to identify as having an ancestry, whatever percentage that may be, of African origin. Now, one of the reasons for that was, as you mentioned, because one is the issue of the census. There's a significant undercount. Part of the reason is the methodologies that have been implemented, and there's been some criticism over the years over the different courses of the round, what they call rounds of censuses in the different countries as to the methodology. But in addition, there is an important need to develop a level of self-awareness within the community. And so there's two things that implicate, right? There's a concept of ethno-education, which is a way to incorporate the contributions of people of African descent into national curricula, which in some places is better than others, but in all places, it's not where it should be. And that will create a level of awareness, and that will then translate into a greater understanding within the community itself and within the broader community of what it means to be Afro-descendant and Afro-Latino. So I think the underlying thing is not to necessarily tell people what they are, mm-hmm. but to educate them and let them decide for themselves how they identify. I think that's an important thing. Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of consciousness raising in there. I want to get into that a little further, but just to remind listeners, we're speaking with Brooklyn-based attorney Amilcar Priestley. He's the director of the Afro-Latino Project, which is based in New York, but it has global reach. And I'll tell you, it's the Afro-Latino Project. .org is the website, and we'll give you more details in a moment. How about Brazil? How do they play, obviously, being such a huge country and with the majority Black population?
Mm-hmm. Well, we work with a number of organizations all over. One of the organizations that we work with in Brazil is called Media Etnica, and they are a kind of digital media-based, activist-based organization that is kind of doing some of the similar work to what we're doing. They've actually just built out a facility in Salvador de Bahia, and it's part of it is to encourage a sense of self-awareness amongst Afro-descendant, Afro-Brazilian populations, also to do digital media training of more local Brazilian organizations, women's organizations, the Quilombo organizations, and so they are some of the more prolific. I would say probably Brazil and Colombia have two of the stronger Afro-descendant movements, but in the sense that they've advanced politically speaking. There's more legislation on the books than in other places. I mean, since 2001, you know, there's been legislation introduced and passed in Panama, Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, and Brazil and Colombia were before 2001.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's been a large push, but Brazil is definitely, and Colombia are definitely two that are at the forefront. They have a new minister of the CEPID, the former minister, which is the secretariat for racial democracy, racial equality. Mm-hmm. The former president was secretariat was Luisa Barrios, Minister Luisa Barrios, and I think they're just about to introduce a new president.
But what you see is notwithstanding that legislation, those regulations, those constitutional protections that you see in a number of these countries, Colombia, Brazil, and elsewhere, mm-hmm. the it's not worth the paper that it's written on. And very often what happens is the Afro populations, the Afro-descendant movements in these countries, ultimately see their alliances being built not within the country. They don't identify necessarily, first and foremost, as Colombian or Brazilian. They identify themselves as Afro-Brazilian, Afro-Colombian, and they can see links and alliances easier to forge, or better, perhaps strategically more important to forge, with their brothers and sisters in other parts of the region. So talk a little bit about that and how the decade itself, the UN International Decade for People of African Descent, perhaps provides an opportunity for that kind of cross-border regional mobilization that's essential.
Right. Well, I definitely think that, I mean, the folks in the individual countries, they definitely identify from a national perspective. So the Panamanians definitely, sure. Afro-Panamanians identify as Panamanian.
Sure.
And there are certain traditions and cultures that are unique to particular countries, unique to the experiences of Afro communities in particular countries. But I think what the regional approach does is it allows it to create a broader perspective. It allows it to create a regional understanding that while there are distinct and unique aspects that are particular to certain countries, there are regional issues. For example, the issue that I mentioned of ethno-education, the issues of the census. You know, these are broad issues that are affecting all the countries irrespective. The issues, for example, and it's particularly poignant, you know, you have Black Lives Matter campaign going on right here in the United States as a result of a lot of the racial profiling issues by the police brutality issues that have seen been at the forefront of the news since the summertime. Simultaneously, there's a campaign in Brazil called Jovem Negro Vivo, which deals with the exact same issue.
Right.
You know, so these are issues that transcend any national boundary and are affecting people of color, Black folk, regardless of where they are. And so the regional perspective allows theoretically allows and encourages that kind of cross-border solidarity and understanding and coalition building.
Mm-hmm, which is essential for here, right here in New York City.
Right.
When you think of, I mean, the Afro-Boricuas, Afro-Dominicans, Panamanians, Colombians,
right.
They're going to get hit by cops. They're going to know
as
whether they're Panamanian, Colombian.
Africans, Caribbean folks, everybody.
So,
yeah,
Black
we're
lives,
all in it together.
Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
So that's great, and it's true. You're right. And in fact, if anything, the argument that organizations across the continent in Venezuela elsewhere have said is that we are Venezuelan, you know, and it's time to recognize and to, you know, draw our rights and so that's part of the mobilizing thing. I wasn't saying that there wasn't distinctions, but clearly this possibility of trans-American, Pan-American mobilization around is very opportune.
Absolutely.
Again, we're speaking with Amir Karp Priestley. I can spend hours, and I want to open the microphone in the studio to the Afro-Latino Project. I hope we can build collaborations, given the fact that you're documenting lives, you're documenting experiences, you're recording testimonials and oral histories of people from across the continent. I hope that we can hear some of those on WBAI here on the air, but also perhaps through our website. So talk about these projects, these particular initiatives, the oral histories, the digital kind of collection of this information.
Sure. So essentially what we've done is, partly on our own and partly by creating, initially we had on our website an embedded digital recorder, and we've kind of developed various toolkits where folks can record their own oral histories. They can, you know, using WhatsApp, we launched what's called, our oral history component is called Conversemos Afro, and that is, you know, just a digital collection and preservation of our cultures, experiences, and contributions using digital mobile phones, Skype, WhatsApp, and a number of different Web 2.0 tools. And so as a result of that, you know, we've been fortunate enough to collect a pretty broad range, but this is a work in progress where I still feel that we are at our infancy in a positive way. And actually, we just recently launched our Kickstarter campaign called Afro Latinos Presente, which the objective of that is to expand our archive. And so we want to redesign the website to improve our back-end infrastructure, to make it more searchable and functional for the community, for users. We also want to expand the number of oral histories that we've collected. Like I said, we've collected 70 from over 10 countries, but we want to continue to grow continuously. We also want to hire 2 interns to help us with the archival process. Some of the funds will go to editing up to 15 of our existing oral histories, and it will go to conducting 2 digital oral history collection and preservation workshops with community organizations. In this day and age, it's hard. Things are hard to get funded, and so we want to be able to provide some kind of opportunity and incentive to encourage organizations to get their folks together to do this work, because it's important work.
Well, we're going to link the website afrolatinoproject.org to WBAI's WBAI.org, our website, and perhaps you can find out more about the Kickstarter campaign. We're quickly running out of time, but I know you're planning an event later this month here in January. Any details you can share with us?
Well, we're looking to do an event. We're working on solidifying the date, but it would be more likely than not up at Mist Harlem, which is on 116th and Lenox, which recently relaunched. And it would be in conjunction with a number of local organizations. And so we are hoping to have that either on the 20th or the 26th of this month. But please check out our website for more information, more details, because we will be sure to update it then. We can also check us out on Twitter at Afro Latin Project, without the T. And on our Facebook, the Afro Latino Project.
Right. So again, we'll detail that on the WBAI homepage. We've been speaking with attorney Amilcar Priestley. He's the director of the Afro Latino Project, a New York native and a graduate of Brooklyn Law School. Again, the website is afrolatinoproject.org. I suggest you check it out and support it, and we'll give you details when that event comes closer. Amilcar, yes. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Mario. It was a pleasure. It was great talking to you. Thanks again.
Bye. La historia.